And I'll just say briefly that I've talked with staff and a number of members of the commission who have been on some of the recent tours and have had very positive feedback about the success of the tours. One of our colleagues on the commission talked about the Brainerd tour recently, talked with me this morning about it, and he said that even though part of this was in his district, he had never been to this food shelf before, and was eye-opening for legislators. I think even in our own districts we're finding things. So I think the people who have been organizing the tours deserve a lot of credit for what's been happening with that. We have one small business item, and that is to adopt the minutes of the previous meeting. Representative Mariani moves the adoption of the minutes. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair? Just very quickly, let me just say that we had a very, in some respects, an unusual meeting. Last meeting, we structured a conversation separate from the way we typically conduct business here with an outside facilitator. And some of the feedback that I got back from a number of folks who were in the audience from the advocate communities, very positive about our willingness to be able to do that, kind of step outside our comfort zone, and to have a conversation that was very honest and very, free of, sort of the typical restraints that we have in terms of how we conduct our business here. And I hope that we can continue to have that spirit in the future, and I hope that in the future we can structure similar type of meetings here along those lines. So a very successful meeting last meeting, I thought, and I want to thank all the commission members for coming and being open and honest and, willing to do something new.
So with that, if there are no changes in the minutes, on Representative Mariani's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. I want to start by deviating from the agenda for just a minute. Sue Watlaw Phillips from ULIM Housing, you had a packet to hand out from HUD, the newest information on the HUD bill. Could you do that now and speak to the maybe 2 minutes? I don't know if the packets were handed out.
I think they're over on the table.
Okay, we'll make sure they get handed out. But go ahead and just explain briefly.
Sure. My name is Sue Watlow Phillips. I'm the executive director of ELIM Transitional Housing with the Minnesota Coalition for the Homeless and past president of the National Coalition for the Homeless. What I want to just briefly talk about is the impact that we will see here in Minnesota if the president chooses to veto the HUD bill that is moving in Congress right now and is in the final stages right now of going to him. And the information that you have before you is from both the National Low Income Housing Coalition as well as the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. While that's coming out, the main piece that I'm looking at is one that looks like this that has a couple pages attached to that, which will give you specifically the Minnesota detail. But while that's being handed out, let me just tell you a little bit about what will happen. If the president does veto it and requires basically his funding level to go forward, Section 8 housing vouchers, we will lose 25,000 vouchers from 2007 that will not be renewed in 2008 across the country. Public housing will face the deepest funding shortfalls in the program's history. Private owners of nearly 1 million apartments assisted under the project-based Section 8 program will be required to accept renewal contracts that guarantee only a few months of assistance. And what we've heard is that those renewal contracts will be every 3 to 4 months that they'll have to sign renewals on project Section 8, which many, obviously, landlords are not going to be willing to do. Funding provided under the 202, which is elderly housing, and the 811, which is permanent housing for people with disabilities, will fall by 22% and 47%, which will mean a reduction of a significant number of units. And state and local units of government will lose $1.2 billion in community development block grant or CDBG dollars in 2008. In addition, the $200 million approved by Congress to deal with the growing rates of mortgage defaults or foreclosures will be eliminated in the HUD budget. If you have that packet in front of you that I'm looking at right now, look at the second page in This is how the impacts will happen state by state. I did copy off all the states, but what I have circled is in Minnesota, we will lose 340 Section 8 housing choice vouchers. People that presently are in Section 8 vouchers will lose their vouchers. There will not be enough money to fund those folks. And this, the fiscal year that we're talking about started October 1st of 2007. Okay, so we are in this fiscal year that we're talking about right now that we're losing federal dollars, potentially losing federal dollars. Project-based Section 8 assistance, we're looking at 6,776 units of folks that may opt out of not continuing to provide project-based Section 8 here in Minnesota. Public housing, we will lose 7,921,538. And in community block grants, we will lose $17,455,653. If you look at the following page, then you have the Minnesota detailed of where we potentially could lose some of those units of the project-based Section 8. Not all these 15,135 units in each of those congressional districts will be lost, but those are folks that are up for renewals on their contracts, and if they don't like this new deal of having to sign an agreement every 3 to 4 months, that's where that number of 6,776 that's on the previous page comes from in regards to Section 8. Obviously, as we're talking about the long-term homeless program, which is a very helpful program. Minnesota has always been a state model in regards to demonstrating how to prevent people from becoming homeless. We were one of the first states to pass transitional housing legislation in 1984, housing trust fund legislation in 1988, the Family Homeless Prevention Act in 1993, and then this being the first state to develop a long-term homeless plan. That plan, the business plan that the governor put together, is dependent upon federal resources. This will significantly impact our ability to be successful in that plan to end homelessness for long-term homeless folks as well as all folks that are at risk or experiencing homelessness. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the commission? If not, thank you very much for the presentation. We're going to start with a presentation on the governor's initiative. Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, I'm sorry, I just wanted to add that I think Ms. Wadlaw Phillips brought plenty of copies, so if anyone in the public wants to have access to those, see her over there in that corner. So.
We're going to begin now with the governor's initiative for ending long-term homelessness. And Laura Cadwell, welcome to the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my colleague, Sherry Shellquist, is actually going to lead with a bit of an overview of the Housing Finance Agency.
Oh, okay.
Thank you, Commissioners. I'm going to provide a brief background on Minnesota Housing, an overview of the agency's work to assist in providing affordable housing to end poverty. The presentation will consist of an overview of our mission, our strategic priorities, our program delivery focused on the ones that meet the needs of the lowest income Minnesotans, and it also includes some information on Minnesota's housing record and current challenges, which I provided more information in the PowerPoint than I will cover today. The mission of Minnesota Housing is to finance and advance affordable housing opportunities for low and moderate income Minnesotans and to enhance the quality of life and foster strong communities. We have four strategic priorities: to finance new affordable housing opportunities, to preserve existing affordable housing. The comments that Sue Wattla Phillips provided earlier are directly connected to these two strategic priorities of the agency. The federal government's disinvestment in affordable housing is something that the agency is aware of and appreciative of all other funds, especially funds provided by the state legislature. Our other two strategic priorities are ending long-term homelessness, which Director Cadwell will address, and increasing emerging market homeownership. We have five program activity areas. Preventing homelessness and supportive housing, I'll provide additional information about. The other areas are development and homes for working families, home ownership loans, preservation, and resident and organizational support. The three main programs focused on preventing homelessness and supportive housing are the Family Homeless Prevention Program, Housing Trust Fund, and Bridges. These programs provide rental assistance, temporary assistance to resolve a housing emergency, and financial assistance with capital costs of rental housing for very low-income households. The median annual income of a household served are generally under $10,000. These programs are delivered through local housing authorities, community action agencies, counties, as well as for-profit and nonprofit developers, and increasingly service providers, which Director Cadwell will also address. I provided additional information on our Family Homeless Prevention Program, which we're also very appreciative, has received $15 million from the state legislature to provide assistance to households facing a crisis that are likely to result in homelessness, and also to households who are homeless to move them into permanent housing as quickly as possible. Our Housing Trust Fund program received $6 million, and that's to sustain commitments already made for rental assistance and to provide additional housing opportunities. Our Bridges program was $4 million to increase the number of persons served with rental assistance who have mental health issues. The important part to note here is that while our state appropriated programs are only 9.4% of the agency's overall budget, they provide the most flexibility to meet the true needs of lowest income Minnesotans. These are the programs that really make the difference in ending homelessness and in ending poverty.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roblin.
Are we going to be allowed to ask questions now?
Go ahead.
I'm wondering, on the very first one, the $15 million to provide assistance to households facing a crisis, and you said this is flexible money. So can you give us some examples of uses for that money?
Right. The Family Homeless Prevention Program is very flexible in that it's a locally determined, we let each local region determine how to use those funds. It can be used anywhere from someone had an issue where they lost employment income and they have another job, but they just need assistance in paying rent for 1 or 2 months so they can keep their apartment. It can be someone that had a health issue and is in recovering, but will soon be able to afford their rent. And so it's a gap in that area. This program has also been used to provide security deposits and first month's rent. Many families that are returning from the Iraq and Afghanistan war have access to this fund to help them get resettled when they return in an apartment. And those are the types of things that are used on the preventative side. Also on the rapidly rehousing side, it's used to help get people out of an emergency shelter situation, or if they are homeless, to get them as quickly as possible back into a rental situation. Many areas of the state also use this for mortgage assistance, but not in the mortgage foreclosure prevention assistance way. There's other programs for this, but it's more on if someone maybe had a health problem and missed a mortgage payment, and they can get back on track quickly. The purpose of this program is to be innovative, though, so each local region can determine what their needs are. It was started before emergency assistance, and so it now is being used more than before to meet emergency assistance needs.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Roblin.
And what is the demand? Does this $15 million come anywhere near to the demand?
The previous biennium, we had a $7.5 million budget from the legislature, and we actually, Laura was very involved in calling together focus groups to identify the unmet need. And we determined that this amount would certainly assist. I think the most each heading home plan, which Laura will also address, has further identified this need for prevention and is setting their own goals. Is there something you'd like to add?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the one thing I would add is that when we did an estimate a year ago, we concluded that it would take about $20 million a biennium to fund the program the way it's offered right now statewide. And we have, as Ms. Schoquist has pointed out, $15 million for the biennium. So it doesn't quite cover the need. And the entire state is not covered. This money is distributed on a grant proposal basis. And so the system at this point is probably handling all of the money it can handle in terms of capacity, but it's definitely an area that I think we want to pay attention to in terms of if we're going to prevent homelessness, is this a sufficient way of doing it?
Mr. Chair, how many grant applicants were there compared to the money that you had to give out?
Senator Roebling, I'm not sure that I can accurately answer that question. Do you know? Okay.
No, great. But I can add that all of the applications were funded.
Yes.
We did provide technical assistance to some of the counties that did not apply, and I'm not sure the exact reasons why they chose not to apply. We think there's areas that the program can be expanded to. We would like to see that.
And Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, we would be happy to provide you with a list of the areas that are funded and the amount that they're getting.
Just one more quick question. Do most of the applicants, are they like CAP agencies, or who is the facilitator for the grant?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, they are CAPs, they are counties, they are other social services agencies, and a lot of the CAPs and counties that receive the money then subcontract with providers. I think there are 60-some providers in all that are feeding into this program in some way, shape, or form.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
I guess I have a follow-up question on that, too. I can picture an awful lot of families where there's been a divorce, a serious illness, a loss of job, and, you know, they need a month or two of mortgage assistance, rent assistance. Otherwise, they're going to lose everything and start from scratch. I'm curious, when you mentioned that that you funded everyone that you had out there, why would a CAP agency not apply? I mean, I'm just curious about that because I can't picture any area of the state where there isn't fairly significant number of households that could desperately use this.
Mr. Chair, I think the primary reason that people don't apply is that they don't think they have the capacity to manage the program. There is a program requirement that the area that administers the program has to put together an advisory committee and have input from the community and so on. And if judging from both what I know and what I would infer from what the things that I've heard, it's mostly a matter of feeling the lack of capacity.
Additionally, most of the advisory committees are cross-county, so there's multiple county, multiple CAP agencies. It's very collaborative in nature, and I think that adds to the complexity of figuring out what's best for each region in making an application.
Please proceed.
This is the last slide that I wanted to review, and that is how our resources are targeted to those with the greatest housing need and related challenges. This is just a chart showing that 41% of the households served in 2006 had incomes under $9,000 a year. 34% were $10,000 to $20,000, 11% $20,000 to $30,000, 5% $30,000 to $40,000, and then 9% were over $40,000. And one thing I want to comment on that over $40,000 is we do have a first-time homebuyer program, and we also fund quite a few mixed-income developments that mixes affordable housing with market-rate housing and very low-income housing. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll just keep
Mr. Chair and members of the Commission, I'm going to spend just a few minutes talking about the plan to end long-term homelessness in Minnesota. This is work that began in this state on a bipartisan basis between the governor and members of the legislature in 2003. The actual plan goes from 2004 through 2010, so we are just about at the halfway point of implementing the plan. We see this plan as directly on point with the issue of ending poverty in Minnesota. People with long histories of homelessness are some of the most poor and vulnerable people in our state. And it's important to note that while long-term homelessness is not solely a function of poverty, almost all, if not all, people who have been homeless for long periods of time are poor. And so it's a way of getting at one of the core issues affecting people who are poor. This slide gives you some idea of the makeup of people experiencing long-term homelessness in Minnesota. You can see the percentage of those that have a chemical dependency issue, those who have mental illness, those who are veterans. Those, and you'll notice that this is a high percentage, over a third, have a prior history, a history of prior incarceration. One of the questions that frequently comes up is, why are we addressing long-term homelessness rather than looking across the board at all homelessness in our state? And there are really two reasons for that. One is the obvious one of, these are people who have been on the streets some as long as 20 years. The most vulnerable, the most sickest, if you think in terms of mental illness and in many cases physical illness. So it's an issue of getting at a really vulnerable issues of a really vulnerable population. The second, quite frankly, is also that this is a population that spends a lot of resources. These are the people who show up in detox. They're the ones who show up in emergency rooms. They're the people, obviously, who are in shelters. We are spending a lot of money to maintain people in homelessness. The effort that we as a state have embarked on beginning in 2004 is to change that paradigm from managing homelessness in shelters and soup kitchens and so on to ending homelessness, so that when we are spending the public dollar, or in many cases private dollars, we are doing it in a way that improves people's lives rather than maintaining them in a situation where they continue to deteriorate. This just gives you a few facts about the background of the business plan. I mentioned that it was developed in 2003. We recalibrated it this year, taking a look at the numbers and making sure we were on track. There is a single strategy to the business plan, and that is to develop 4,000 new permanent supportive housing opportunities for families, individuals, and unaccompanied youth who have experienced long-term homelessness. Sherry has talked about prevention, and I will mention prevention a little bit later in my presentation as well. But these other efforts are really outside of the core business plan, which is to address the issues of people who have been in homelessness for long periods of time in our state. Since the business plan was developed, it has grown into really something larger, for lack of a better way of saying it, than the business plan itself. Because many regional areas in Minnesota, notably Hennepin County, Ramsey County, St. Louis County, and a group of 20 counties in southeast Minnesota, have also developed plans to end either long-term homelessness or a broader plan to end homelessness, we have developed an umbrella, if you will, called Heading Home Minnesota, which incorporates all of these plans. They're not all the same, but they are all aligned, and they're all heading in the direction of ending homelessness in our state. You'll notice in the bottom bullet point that the governance of this Heading Home Minnesota effort includes not only people like me who are involved in implementation, but also folks from the private sector, from faith communities, and from the business community. We have quite a large steering committee at this point that I think you will be hearing from in coming months, of leaders in the philanthropic, business, and faith communities who are on board with this effort and are developing ways that they can align their giving and their energies, if you will, with ending homelessness in our state. The business plan is backed by a financing plan, and you'll see in the right-hand columns the costs of the various pieces, the costs of developing permanent supportive housing, of providing the services in that housing. Permanent supportive housing means housing with services, and the whole idea is that services help people who have been homeless for long periods of time remain in housing. A lot of people who suffer from severe mental illness, for example, can't maintain their housing without appropriate services. Conversely, the housing makes the services much more cost-effective. Imagine, if you will, providing mental health services to somebody who goes back and lives on a riverbank or in a shelter. If we really want the expenditure of services dollars to be effective, it behooves us all to make sure people are in housing and have a stable place to live. The left-hand side of the chart shows you sources that we have identified and some that we have not identified. And Ms. Watlow Phillips mentioned in her presentation the relationship between this plan and the federal budget. And there is one. And it's a serious issue, what is happening at the federal level for the continuation of our business plan, especially as we get further and further into implementation, and as we think about maintaining the strides that we have made in the course of implementation. The next slide shows where we are in our progress. The goal was to have funded 1,600 housing opportunities by the end of 2007. As of now, we've funded 1,661, so we are actually a little bit ahead of the goal. You can see what the goal is for 2008. It is to fund an additional 800 housing opportunities, and then the final goal of 4,000. All of the numbers that we're using, by the way, are based on data from Wilder Research, and so they are data that are specific to Minnesota. I should also mention that a housing opportunity here does not necessarily involve capital development. Approximately 40% of the housing opportunities that have been funded to date involve building something. The rest involves simply putting rental assistance with the necessary services and using housing in the private market. So people get into apartments through this program and have some assistance in paying their rent. Of the ones that have been developed so far, about three-quarters are in the Twin Cities, which tracks pretty well with the number of folks experiencing long-term homelessness, the proportion in our state. About 45% are families. We are one of the few places, we are one of the leaders, actually, in making sure that when we talk about ending homelessness for populations, we include families. This is not just about singles. Here are some data. I won't belabor these because I know we don't have a lot of time, but about people. These are data from our homeless management information system talking about what characteristics of people who actually have experienced long-term homelessness and are now in housing. And I would simply call your attention to the last piece of data on this slide. Of those currently in housing, 36% have maintained housing for more than a year. This is one of the most important markers that we're looking for. One of the biggest outcomes we want is for people to stay in housing. Now, 36% may seem low, but the fact is the majority of households that are represented in that number haven't had an opportunity to be there for a year yet. We're still ramping up. People are still moving into housing. So that's not a bad number, and obviously as time goes on, we will see a higher and higher percentage of people staying in housing, or if we don't, we'll be asking a lot of questions. I wanted simply to make you aware of the extent to which the governor and the state legislature have stepped up to support this plan. And I won't go through the detail of this slide. Suffice it to say that there is bonding money, there is services money, there is money for rental assistance, some outreach money, some money for mental health services in this the mix of money that's going into this program. I think that you are fortunate to have three state agencies, Minnesota Housing, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Corrections leading this effort. And all of these agencies have come to the legislature asking for pieces that when they come back around, fund this plan, that they're coordinated on the back end, and once they go through the legislature, the money that goes to corrections, the money that goes to human services, the money that goes to housing is coordinated and aligned with this effort to end long-term homelessness. With that, I will stop. You have my details there if you want to reach me, and I'm happy to answer questions, and I know Ms. Shoquist is as well.
Representative Swalwick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cadwell, good presentation, and I think you're making a lot of progress. However, I just want to get your comment. A lot of us went on the poverty tours in the Twin Cities, and when we were at Dorothy Day, Representative Mariani asked the head of Catholic Charities, I can't remember his name, he's the
Father Estrom.
Father Estrom, sort of what was happening with homelessness and progress. And he said they pretty much steadily have, I think it's 650 people a night. And he said, in essence, actually, Representative Mariani, your question was worded much more elegantly than this, but his response was, he said, well, in fact, and why aren't we making more progress? He said, in fact, we've sort of institutionalized homelessness by providing shelter for that many people per night. You know, they can be there as long as they need to be there. And he said, what we haven't done is provide that infrastructure underneath that to get people out of homelessness and out into the community and support them with mental health services and things like that. Now, that some ways would be it wouldn't be supported by the evidence you're providing, or what? Why doesn't that quite sync with what you're saying? Are we seeing different populations? Or,
Mr. Chair and Representative Slavik, what I believe is that the stories are consistent, in my view, in the sense that when you dig down into the numbers here, we're only talking so far about a few hundred households. And so I think that the proof will be in the pudding, as they say, as we continue to go through implementation of this plan, because the actually getting people into housing takes some time even after that opportunity is funded. It takes most time, obviously, if we're building something. Even if it's providing rental assistance, it takes a few months to get somebody into the housing. Father Estrom is one of the key people behind this initiative, and I'm happy that he was there to talk with people, because he understands probably more than anybody what it is we're trying to do in moving from what he does so well, and it's so important to have people have a place to stay on a night like tonight, for example, but moving from that paradigm to a completely different way of looking at this issue, which is that we'll never be able to guarantee that somebody won't become homeless. The issue is, what happens when they become homeless? Where do they go, and how quickly can we rehouse people? And he's very much a part of looking at different ways of doing this. For example, we have a number of different types of housing opportunities. There are opportunities for people who want to have a very structured environment where, for example, they're required to remain sober. There are other people who will never come in if they have to remain sober, even though there's evidence that once they get in and have a more humane way of life, a better place to live, they gradually taper off their drinking, interestingly enough. So anyway, my point is simply lots of models, lots of things we're doing. I think we'll see the numbers improve as time goes along, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
Mr. Chair, just a comment. I hope we do, because when he says that number's pretty stable, obviously in my mind, your efforts in that are supposed to bring that number should come down as your numbers go up, although you know, people may move into the state and the economy and so forth. But I appreciate what you're saying, and hope we can see a closer correlation.
Representative Slowick, I think we're all trying not to think of this as the myth of Sisyphus, because it is a big challenge. And we are trying to keep tabs on where are people coming from who are newly in homelessness, and how does that square, asking all these questions. So I'm happy to have you ask them.
Can I just also have a follow-up question to that? Because I know the program's pretty new, and I know Catholic Charities' name has come up a couple times. I think they've moved 100 people into housing already from the long-term homeless initiatives. But on the short-term initiatives, can you explain a little bit about the additional funding that's becoming available now to provide case managers to work with individuals who are newly homeless so that they don't become long-term homeless? Because I know that's a recent addition and has been really helping to identify people much sooner and get them plugged into resources.
Right. And Mr. Chair, Ms. Bauer, much of that effort goes on through the Family Homeless Prevention and Assistance Program as far as any kind of state effort is concerned. But a lot of private foundations are also in the business of trying to both provide case management and provide those things that people need quickly. Sometimes it's financial counseling. Sometimes it's a place to live temporarily. I mean, there are all kinds of things. It's a bit of the answer to Senator Roebling's question earlier. Interestingly enough, one of the things that the McKnight Foundation did when this business plan began was to seed a fund that we can use to respond to requests for funding that things that the state doesn't fund and that the counties don't fund. That's where a lot of that money both comes and goes. We have a way of getting money out to nonprofits out in the community who can provide case management. They can provide housing assistance, helping people figure out where the next place is that they can live and getting them into it and so on. There's a lot going on in the community along the lines that you suggest.
Representative Lanning, then Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cadwell, a couple questions. I take it that most of the resources that are available are controlled by some other agency or department. And so is it the role of your initiative to help direct or advise people where they might go to get some help or support for what they're trying to do in local communities? Is that your role?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, my role is primarily to coordinate the work of those departments. And most of what we're doing, and I'll use the work that Minnesota Housing does to respond to developers who want to build things, requires the coordination of Human Services and Minnesota Housing because we need services in those places to live. And so the housing people consult with the human services people. Part of my job is bringing that all together. Part of my job, I have thought about putting a sign on my door that says staff person to the world, because there is an element of this job that is exactly what you said. It's when people call, helping, you know, directing them to the right resource so that they know where to go, whether it's a community organization or a state agency. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. You don't have a lot of resources as an office all by yourself, but money that's been appropriated by the legislature that to various initiatives, you can help coordinate access to those.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, that's correct. And to be perfectly honest, I have seen an amazing amount of interagency cooperation in this initiative. I think it another sort of case study, if you will, in this initiative is the extent to which government agencies are coming together, including the seven counties in the metro area that came together to jointly administer their services funding through this initiative. And I heard someone call it unprecedented. So I think that there's a lot to be proud of. Those of you who have help to fund and think about this program and design this program, a lot to be proud of in terms of how it's working.
One last question, if I might, Mr. Chair. I know that there are communities out there that have had HUD projects over the years ago, maybe 30, 40 years ago or more. And HUD, as everybody knows, has been trying to get out of the housing business and has really been providing inadequate funding to maintain these facilities. And I know of one in particular in my community. They're going to have to come up with $5 million, or the people who are in that facility could very well, many of them, end up on the street and exacerbate our problem. Can you help a situation like this in terms of how can we deal with this? Obviously, we keep after HUD, that's been a very difficult nut to crack.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, I'm not sure without knowing more whether I can, but I'd be happy to contact your office and get some more details and work with the housing agency to see what we can do.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Roebling.
Thank you. I'm wondering, you said you had case managers to help prevent homelessness, But at this point, you had a 36% retention rate, and with hopes that that would improve. Do we have case managers to help? Since two-thirds of the people who we're working with have some kind of a disability, mental health issues, abuse issues, or chemical dependency issues, do they have supportive services? I work with someone who is mentally ill, and she has Section 8, but she has to pay a third every month. If she weren't reminded that her rent payment was due, she would never remember to pay the rent. And I don't know how many times that could happen before she'd be booted out of the apartment or out of the program. But she needs to have somebody there all the time. Is that something you see frequently, is that people don't remember that they have to do certain things to stay in the housing that they're in?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, you have drawn a perfect example of why the services have to be combined with the housing. And the answer is yes. Each of the units that's created under this plan has both housing and services. And so in the case of someone with a mental illness, then the services are designed to address the mental illness. And in many cases, the provider that has paired up with the housing developer is specifically a mental health resources is the name of a provider, and they are one of the providers that is part of the business plan. And there are a number of specifically agencies designed or working specifically on mental health issues, others on chemical dependency, some on all of the above.
And what follow-up on the Department of Corrections? When they get money for transitional housing or the reentry projects, how do they have a way of working around the issue of landlords who don't want convicted felons living in their rental units? As we toured, we have found this to be a really big barrier, that anyone with a felony record has a very difficult time finding housing. And does the DOC have a method of getting through that somehow and helping them?
Mr. Chair and Senator Roebling, the best thing I can tell you is that the transitional housing units that they have are out in the community. And so somehow they have developed relationships with landlords that are taking people who have some criminal background. The same is true for this initiative because, as you saw, over a third of the people who we're looking at as coming in through the long-term homeless door, if you will, have a history of incarceration. And again, places like St. Stephen's, places like Project for Pride and Living have been working with landlords so that they have something out in the community, so that they have landlords in the community who are, for lack of a better way of saying it, willing to take a chance on these folks. And one of the reasons, we've actually heard a landlord say that getting involved with this initiative, and this was in the city of Minneapolis, was one of the best business decisions he ever made. And the reason he says that is that there is a service provider who is the intermediary between the landlord and whatever difficulty he may be experiencing. Otherwise, he's just got a problem on his hands.
I think when we were on the tours I've been on, too, the discussion of prior incarceration prevents people from getting jobs, housing, that's everything. Right. So, Representative Mariani, you had a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Cadwell. And, I want to acknowledge and congratulate you for your efforts and your work.
Thank you.
This is really, in many ways, historic work for the state of Minnesota. And, we're very fortunate to have someone who can think very collaboratively in terms of providing some leadership. So I want to thank you for that. As I look at, back on slide 18, where we looked at the different populations of communities experiencing long-term homelessness, people with mental illnesses, chemical dependency, dual diagnosis, veterans, victims of domestic violence, individuals with felony records, and then brain injury, people with brain injury. In terms of where we're at right now, what can you tell us has there been any distinctions in terms of, what population of people have been the most, we've had most difficulty in terms of moving into permanent housing scenarios. What have there been sort of important distinctions that have had to be been developed in terms of our ongoing planning in regards to those particular populations? And I think Commissioner Bauer had shared that she thought there was about 100 people that we've so far been able to move, you know, as a result of this effort into permanent housing situation. Can you tell us how that breaks down in terms of these subgroups of individuals?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, I don't think we have enough granularity yet to really answer that question adequately. What we do know is that there is a subset that we do know that there are many people that go into housing and with the proper services stay housed. And we have some statistics and we have some anecdotal evidence. We also know that and stories. We also know that there is a subset of the population that is very difficult to keep in housing. We haven't, to my knowledge, and maybe you have some more information, Sherry, than I do on this, but to my knowledge, we don't yet really have the picture drawn of, is there a relationship between length of time homeless and the ability to stay in housing? Is there a relationship between, is it people who are more, is it more likely to be people with a mental illness or people with a brain injury? We do know that there have been people with brain injuries who are not properly diagnosed and they end up getting treatment as if they had a mental illness that doesn't work, and so they're not successful in their housing. We've got anecdotes like that. I can't answer your question with hard data, though.
Representative Mariani, one thing I could add is it's very much about matching the person with the right program and meeting their needs. There's an array of different housing options, and it's people don't always know which one will be the best. And so the thing that I think is important about this initiative is the services stay with the person and can follow them from one housing situation to another. So maybe scattered site is what will work for them than, you know, in a rental subsidy situation out in the community, or maybe they need a setting where there are other people there that can provide them services on site and people that they can meet with and, you know, have group discussion about and kind of grow together. So there's sober housing, there's wet housing, there's an array, and I think it's finding the right match for people. And that's one thing that doesn't always happen in the community. If you don't fit into this program, then you end the program and where do you go? Where with the Ending Long-Term Homelessness Initiative, the services stay with you. And so the services can assist you in finding the right housing or the right housing program that meets your needs.
Mr. Chair, I think I get it. I mean, I understand the framework of aligning the services to the need and then tying that to permanent housing. I'm just trying to get a feel for, you know, what areas are the most difficult areas to align services for, and maybe we just don't have enough of a, you know, sort of a matrix, you know, an experience of being able yet within this framework to do that. But I'm suspecting that there are certain populations where that's going to be, relatively speaking, much more difficult for others. But I beyond that, I'm only conjecturing on what those might be. And so I was just looking to see if there's anything based on your experience that can point us to where those might be.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, as I said, I'm not sure of anything off the top of my head, but you've given me something to go back to the office and look for. And if we do have something, I will forward it to you. And we will be keeping an eye on that issue because, obviously, if we're going to be successful, we have to learn the answer to that question.
Well, Mr. Chair, when we were up in the last tour that I was on up north in Brainerd, we were able to interact with a terrific program that does a sort of a work release for folks to build affordable housing. So that's great up in the, I think it was in the Brainerd area. We heard some very, very disturbing scenarios from these felons who are looking to, you know, for a second chance, but who are understanding from the get-go that housing is going to be probably one of their single most biggest issue as a, you know, in order to meet the condition of their probation. And all of them articulating a real fear that that alone may just, you know, slip them right back into jail at some point. I'm wondering, Commissioner Bauer talked about 100 individuals so far. Have we benchmarked our efforts in so how does 100 compare to where we thought we would be or where we want to be? I mean, how are we, you know, are we setting up a sort of a process here to, for us to be able to track the efficacy of this effort and the timing of it? And
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, I would call your attention to a couple of things. One is I neglected to mention that this is our two-page cheat sheet, everything you ever wanted to know about the business plan to end long-term homelessness. The graph that has the bars on it, which is I'm not sure what the number slide is when they're put together here, but in any case, we do know how many housing opportunities have been funded through the business plan, and the goal, we have goals each year. The goal in 2004 was 200, and 2005 was 400, and then 600. And next year the goal, and each succeeding year, 8, 9, and 10, will be 800. And so we know whether we've reached those goals in terms of actually funding the creation of a housing opportunity. And then through the Homeless Management Information System, we are able to figure out how many people are actually in the housing, because there is that lag that I mentioned earlier. So, yes, I would say. And what we do if we find that the, for example, a rental administrator might get 20 vouchers of rental assistance. And if we find that they're not actually being used after 3 months, we find out why and make sure that we stay on top of keeping that lag time down so that people will get into housing as quickly as possible after the funding becomes available. Does that answer your question?
No, I'm not sure it does. But, I mean, I think, you know, what I'm looking at sort of kind of at the big, you know, foot level, you know, how do we know whether this is ultimately being effective in terms of what we're seeing now, concretely moving people forward? And, you know, how does that match up to where we thought we would be? But I can follow up more with you on this. I think I'm probably not grasping this. Maybe just one final question. So we have this, the statewide, effort to end long-term homelessness. We have this commission that has this universal, mandate to ending poverty. What is the one single learning lesson for you in your work and your mission that you would share with this commission as an important dynamic for us to pay attention in terms of trying to meet our similar but broader goal?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, the first thing I'm going to say is going to sound a bit self-serving, but in the spirit of getting the job done, I think that the goal of ending poverty is a hugely important goal, and it can't be done without ending long-term homelessness. In other words, that this is a subset of the work that you're doing. And you can expand this work in a whole lot of different ways to get closer to the goal of ending poverty, it seems to me. Interestingly enough, when Ramsey County started to put its plan, Heading Home Ramsey, together, they grappled with the question of what's the difference between ending homelessness and ending poverty. And I'm kind of simple-minded about this. I think that you can end homelessness without ending poverty. I don't think that you can do it the other way around. And I also think that while each piece, whether it's providing child care, making sure there's enough child care subsidies, or addressing the health care issues, or I know that you're going to hear a presentation on MFIP in a little bit here. While each of those pieces is important, I would posit that none of them will be really successful unless we pay attention to whether people are housed, and I think that's particularly true of children. We know that children who are homeless are at high risk of being homeless as adults, and so it's another place where we can intervene and say, if we want folks to grow, if we want children to grow into productive adults, let's start now. Make sure they have a place to live.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, Ms. Cadwell. I mean, I think for us, the charge is so big. That I think, you know, for me, I'm intrigued by the thought of trying to have the commission identify, you know, some big policy levers, you know, that can get us on the right track here. And in many ways, you know, perhaps we've already activated one in terms of your work.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mariani, and I'll make this very brief, if I could just add one more thing. I think in terms of a lesson that I've learned, I think, and you hinted at this earlier, developing some goals and sticking to those goals is really important. And I think you can do that with, I mean, I could see this, let's end poverty, and one of the goals is end long-term homelessness, and then there's another goal in there that you develop outcomes for, similar to the way these outcomes are developed, and stick on it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Appreciate it.
Thank you. One general comment about this, and that is we're dealing here with, I'm told, about 20% of the homeless population. It's the most difficult and the most challenging and critically important to do, but one observation I've heard from some is that at about the time this kicked in, it was about the time we were taking a lot of funds away from short-term homeless people, which tends to be the kids and the families and so on. And that's not an argument for saying we shouldn't be doing this, we should be doing that. I think it's the caution should be that the four-fifths of the homeless folks who are short-term homeless, we got to address that too, and not just because some of them would become long-term if we don't do it, but because that's part of our mission as well. So anyway, I do appreciate what you're doing and appreciate your presentation. So thank you both.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chuck Johnson on a presentation on MFIP changes. Welcome to the commission.
Some handouts, Mr. Chair.
We'll get them distributed. Please proceed, though.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chuck Johnson with the Department of Human Services. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. Thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to the Commission today about the Minnesota Family Investment Program and more broadly what Minnesota has done over the course of the last number of years in the area of welfare reform and helping families achieve self-sufficiency. I want to start a little bit maybe at the end by talking about sort of a conclusion that I think may help be something to keep in mind as I walk through the rest of the information that I'm going to provide. I think by most measures, Minnesota and the nation has been quite successful in welfare reform since 1996 passage of the law. Successful in the sense of transforming the welfare system from a system that largely paid checks to people to a system that really is focused on helping transition off of welfare and into work. But that success, I think, feels limited to a lot of people. And there's a couple of major challenges or perhaps lessons that have been identified coming out of welfare reform over the last 10 years. The welfare reform is brought to light but aren't strictly welfare reform-related issues. The first is really that many of the families that use assistance, use welfare over the course of time, are really not much different than other low-income working families. They just have a spot in time where they do use assistance and pass through the system. And like those families, they face some of the same challenges that those families face in terms of the need for additional income, be it through the child support system or income supplements like tax credits, the need for health care often or child care assistance, and the need for opportunities to upgrade their skills in order to get better jobs in the future. The point there is that while that applies to people who are leaving welfare, it also applies to a lot of other low-income workers who are not on welfare. It's more of a workforce development kind of issue than it is really a welfare reform issue. But it ties to welfare reform, and I think welfare reform has helped to highlight the need for those kinds of thinking around that population. The second lesson is a sense on the other end of the spectrum, and that is that through welfare reform, we have identified families who live in our communities who face some very serious and multiple challenges, not just to becoming self-sufficient, but to basic management of daily life and caring for their children. What happened under the old AFDC program is these are families that would come in through the human services system. They'd come in through the AFDC door. They'd move into the AFDC program, and frequently there would be no other connection with that family other than the monthly check that was being sent to them. Obviously, under welfare reform, we began to engage in a service way with these families, largely through trying to help them get employment, and discovered, quote-unquote, that many of these families had multiple challenges, such as mental health issues, chemical health issues, violence in the home, needs for the children that weren't being met properly because of disability or behavioral issues, and the list goes on. This is really more of a broader lesson for human services. Again, it relates to welfare reform, but it's not just about welfare reform. It's about how we think about our human services delivery system around these families that can deliver services that are more comprehensive and more coordinated in nature than what we have now, which is a very silo-based system that doesn't really quite know how to serve families who have multiple needs that cross those silos. I think those two lessons are important to think about as we think about welfare reform and the challenges that we still face in being fully successful with the low-income families in Minnesota. Let me start by talking about some of the changes in MFIP over time. I did give you a handout. I'm going to start by talking about the MFIP pilot. The MFIP pilot, as many of you are aware, was developed over a long period of time, starting in the late 80s, ran in seven counties from 94 to 1998, was rigorously evaluated using random assignment methodology, which means that we're have very definitive findings in the performance of that program relative to the control group, which was a group of families receiving the traditional AFDC at that time program. And the findings, which have been shared many times since, and I'll just share with you briefly again, because I think they are relevant to this commission's work, 35% increase in employment and a 23% increase in earnings. Those kinds of findings and impacts are similar to the impacts in other welfare reform approaches measured in other states, but larger in nature. Increase in family income and a decrease in poverty for families participating in MFIP relative to the AFDC program. And I think the piece that was certainly surprising at the time were some impacts on families and children as well who participated in the program. A slight increase in marriage amongst single parents and a large increase in marital stability amongst two-parent families. A reduction in violence in the home. It reduced behavior problems for children and improved school performance and attendance for children. So these results, as you probably recall, were heralded at the time, and rightly so. This was the first time and there have been a lot of really good evaluation done on welfare reform efforts, state experiments over the course of the 80s and 90s in this country. This was the first time that a program had shown producing reductions in poverty and increases in income. Typically, what had happened under welfare reform approaches is you'd see an increase in the income and the earnings of the people who were going through the program, but they'd have a like decrease in their benefits. And so as a net income, they'd end up in basically the same place they were when they started. What MFIP did differently was increased, essentially said, you can keep some of your benefits when you go to work, a kind of a sliding scale. The mechanism is called an earned income disregard, meaning we don't count some of your earnings when you go to work, and that allows you to keep more of their benefits. It seems now, in retrospect, like a fairly simple idea. It was fairly radical at the time. AFDC did not have such a structure after 1982. This was really the mechanism that drove the poverty reduction in the MFIP pilot. And it's important to understand that because I think there's been a lot of discussion about the original MFIP being a poverty reduction program, and where are we now? The mechanism is really this earned income disregard that allowed folks to work sometimes part-time, sometimes at a low wage, sometimes at a lower level, sometimes sporadically in and out of work, and see their income go up whenever they work because they had that earned income disregard. The associated piece of this is in looking across evaluations done in other states of similar kinds of programs, it's only in the programs that have this kind of an earning supplement where you also see the benefits on the family and child outcomes. Those programs that essentially increased work but didn't increase income didn't hurt the children in terms of the outcomes that were measured, but didn't produce any positive effects either. So very clearly the income here is a pathway through which we improve child outcomes in these families as well. Now the caveat, and I think the important caveat in this, obviously this commission is thinking about ending poverty, addressing poverty. There's an attraction to the MFIP pilot. There's also a reality check in this. When I talk about reducing poverty, what was actually measured for the group of recipients in the evaluation, at the end of 3 years in the follow-up in the MFIP group, 75% of those families were still in poverty. 85% of the control group were in poverty. That's a significant improvement, but the point is that poverty was still very persistent amongst these families even after 3 years. And clearly, simply the changes that were made in MFIP in and of itself is not going to radically change the nature of poverty in the state. But it is obviously something that has been measured to be effective. So how have we changed since the pilot? What changes have we made in MFIP? I've organized this handout into four sort of eras. I already talked about the pilot. I'm not going to talk about everything that's on here, but the first chunks here is sort of the initial statewide program that ran from 97 to 2003. It's not to say there weren't a lot of changes made during that time. There were, certainly. But the significant changes were made in 2003 and 2007, so I'm going to talk about those somewhat separately. So what were the changes that were made from the pilot program when we moved into the statewide program? To the point that I just talked about, the first one of the changes that was made was a reduction in the earned income disregard. That's the mechanism that allowed folks to keep more of their income when they went to work and drove the poverty reduction. We didn't get rid of the earned income disregard. It was reduced. It was largely for cost reasons because bringing the program to scale statewide was going to be very expensive if we had kept it at exactly the same way it was in the pilot. In the pilot, because of the combination of the grant and the income disregard, when families exited assistance at 140% of the poverty level, when we created the statewide program, the combination of grant and the disregards put the exit level at 120% of poverty. So that was a sense, a way of baselining the change that was made. That 120% was not initially indexed. It was in 2001, and so then it stayed at 120%. Then in 2003, it was dropped to 115%, and that's where we currently are right now. So we currently have an exit level in the program that is above poverty, but is significantly lower than where we were when we were in the pilot. Also, another change that I think is related to this is the pilot, we were allowed to cash out the food stamp benefits. That meant in MFIP, both in the pilot and currently, we really pull the cash benefits and the food stamps under one eligibility umbrella and one benefit determination, which is a great simplification. But in the pilot, it was really an entirely cash benefit, which meant that the family had a lot more flexibility in how they used those dollars and what they could do with them. Federal government would not allow us to do that when we went to the statewide program. So now we have it's a unified benefit, but whether the family gets all cash, some food, or all food, varies depending on how much income they have. And so it's not quite the same in terms of the value, perhaps, to the family as well. There were changes that were made in 1997 related to the drive from the federal TANF legislation, which gave us flexibility to do MFIP statewide, but also had some restrictions in it as well. The first of these was a 60-month time limit. It was added in 1997. In 2001, the legislature created extension categories that allow some families to extend beyond the 60-month time limit if they meet certain categories of disability and so forth. The other change that was driven, I think, by the federal requirements was really the federal law required all states to meet something called a work participation rate, which is really a driver in terms of the state having to have a certain number of families involved in work activities. It's really the federal government's way, Congress's way of saying, we want to make sure the state really stays a work program. And that changed, I think, several things in the statewide program from perhaps the way it was in the pilot. One was there were fairly strict hourly requirements for participants in terms of how many hours a week they had to participate in activities, rather than somewhat more individualized flexibility that existed in the pilot. Secondly, the sanctions, that is the grant reduction that a client sees if they don't cooperate with the work requirements, was increased in the statewide program from where it had been in the pilot. And so those are things that I think were pushed in part by the politics here in Minnesota, but also in part by the federal push on work participation rate. Another area is around allowable educational activities, and this is one I know I was asked specifically to address for the commission. When I'm talking about education here and what is allowable, I'm not talking about the kind of education benefits people get. I'm talking about what's allowed in an employment plan. There are restrictions in law about what kind of education someone can participate in and have it still count as being part of their plan so they aren't getting sanctioned and so forth. Also, you should understand that the kind of benefits that MFIP provides for education, MFIP doesn't create education programs. It basically places people into existing programs in the community, helps them with transportation and book costs sometimes, but for the most part, folks are using normal financial aid and so forth when they're in the MFIP program. Also, there hasn't been much change in terms of basic education policy around MFIP. The change in the debate has really been around post-secondary education, that is, education after high school. What's changed mostly is the amount of time that's allowed. Initially, in the statewide program, folks were allowed 1 year of post-secondary education or a second year on an exception basis. That was changed, I believe it was around 2001, to just be a straight 2 years without the exception basis language. The other thing that's changed is some of the conditions of approval, and the biggest change was in 2003. There was a requirement added that any individual in MFIP who was participating in post-secondary education also had to work 20 hours a week in order to be allowed to participate in the education as well. What hasn't changed over time, I think, is that the program has always been pretty strongly focused on work. That's going back to the pilot and straight through and all the variations of the statewide program. That education has not always been a primary activity into which people were placed. And, in fact, the numbers in people in education have always been quite small. There have always been criteria in law that job counselors at the county have to follow before they can approve an education plan, essentially showing that there are jobs exist for this training, that the training is needed to reach that job goal, that there will be a significant increase in the wage someone can get. So there's conditions that people have to meet in order to be approved for education and training. I said that participation numbers are small. When we look over time, only 5 to 6% of the MFIP caseload at a point in time are participating in post-secondary education activities, about the same percentage in basic education activities. For the most part, that hasn't changed, with one exception, a fairly big one, and that is that the number of folks in post-secondary education did drop post-2003 to where we are currently. Currently, we're only around 2% or so of the caseload participating in post-secondary education. There are probably a couple of things that drove that. One is, I mentioned before, that in 2003 there's a requirement added saying that folks had to work 20 hours a week in order to participate in education. That clearly became a barrier to participating in post-secondary education for a lot of participants based on what we've heard from folks in the field. That was repealed in 2007, so that doesn't exist anymore in state law. The second piece is, this is around the time that we started to feel the pressure, all states, of the work participation rate from the federal government. TANF, the authorizing legislation in Congress, was supposed to be reauthorized in 2002, and it was very clear from the bills that were going around then and the proposals from the administration that there was going to be a ratcheting up of the pressure on states to meet higher work participation rates. So we started in Minnesota to try to ramp ourselves up to do better on our work participation rate to try to meet that challenge. As it happened, it took them about, I guess, 4 or 5 years to actually reauthorize TANF, but there was a lot of activity that changed in the way we managed the program at that time that I think impacted this. A particular piece of this was that Minnesota, starting in 97, had a waiver from the federal TANF law that essentially, under the work participation rate, allowed us to define any activity that was put into a plan as being an allowable activity for the purposes of counting for the TANF work participation rate. The TANF law itself has very particular activities that can count that are laid out in the law. We lost that waiver in 2002, and that affected our ability to have more individualized plans and to count broader kinds of activities as well, and that probably impacted this. Back to sort of the first point I made earlier, I think one of the issues around the education and training is really sort of this broader workforce development issue. A lot of the concern that's been expressed over time in the policy debates on education and training in Minnesota has been really an equity concern. While we're going to have people on MFIP going to school for 2 years and other low-income workers aren't getting that opportunity and can't do it because they're working to try to keep a roof over their head and so forth.
I think that that argument, in a sense, misses that we should be providing these opportunities or figuring out how to make these opportunities work better for all low-income workers. And again, it isn't particularly an MFIP issue per se that should be the focus. This is work that's been going on in the Governor's Workforce Development Council to look at this issue, and also now with a project being funded by the Joyce Foundation called Shifting Gears Project. And I think you folks are hearing about this at your next meeting from people from the GWDC. But that's really focused on how do we look at what we provide within the employment and training system to provide better opportunities for all low-wage workers to upgrade their skills to help meet our future economic needs. Briefly, in 2003, there were a number of changes that were made that were sort of put into two categories. The first category was really around strengthening the focus of the program on work. The biggest piece here was creation of the Diversionary Work Program, which is essentially a short-term, four-month program that new applicants go through, since before they go into MFIP. The design is to try to help get folks off of assistance and alleviate their need for assistance by moving them into work quickly. The 4 months don't count against a 60-month timeline. We have more flexibility around the services we can provide. It's intended to be a very intensive four-month program to help people who are better equipped to make a quick transition into the labor market. In 2003, we also went to a full family sanction, essentially that after a certain period of time, 6 months in current law, a family can lose all of their benefits if they're not cooperating with the work requirements. And we also put in universal participation, which said that every family had to participate in employment and training services regardless of what the circumstances were that the family was facing. Previously, we'd had some exemptions for people in certain categories. There were also some changes made in 2003 that were really just straight budget decisions based on the deficit that we had that year. Counting $50 against the grant for people living in subsidized housing, counting $125 against the grant for folks who are receiving SSI, and dropping the exit level from 120% of poverty to 115. 2007, just this last session, there were a number of changes made again. Some of that was undoing the changes that were made in 2003. The SSI reduction was repealed, 125% SSI-based reduction. The 20-hour work requirement for education I mentioned before, that was also repealed in 2007. The more substantive changes may have been, however, to address the work participation rate. As I mentioned, Congress started out on the path to reauthorize TANF in 2002 and finally did it in 2006. And they did it through the Deficit Reduction Act, which really put states, again, having to be in a much higher work participation rate than we had previously been under. And there were two primary changes that were made, as well as some additional resources being provided to counties to help with the work participation rate. The first was a creation of a Family Stabilization Services. This is essentially a program for a category of families within MFIP who face more significant challenges to becoming self-sufficient. And what putting these families into the Family Stabilization Program does is that program provides different kinds of services, but it also is funded differently using not TANF dollars, but state non-maintenance of effort dollars, which means we don't have to count those families as part of our work participation rate. So it's a way to help us meet the rate by taking some of the more challenging families essentially out of the TANF program, putting them into a sort of parallel program funded with state dollars. Secondly, was the creation of employment bonus that is scheduled to be implemented in 2009. What that will do, and similar to the notion of supplementing people's income, is for families that leave MFIP and are working more than 24 hours a week, it will provide a $75 a month cash supplement to their income for up to 24 months. What that does, other than having an obvious benefit to those families and making that transition off of welfare, is we're allowed to count those families then as workers in our work participation rate because they're receiving the assistance through the $75. So these are two devices, essentially, that were created by the legislature to try to help us meet that challenge of the work participation rate. I wanted to address the outcomes in the MFIP family, MFIP program. What have we found in terms of family outcomes? The best source that we have for that is a longitudinal study that we conducted as a department. There's a lot of data out there in various places. The longitudinal study is a very good study in the sense that it's very detailed and has lots of information. It's somewhat limited in that it is older data. The sample was originally drawn in 1998. I'm citing data that's from 2002 here. And again, back to the earlier themes of the different families, After this four-year follow of the sample that we did in this program in 2002, about half of the families were off MFIP and working. And they were working an average of 40 hours a week, and they were earning an average of $9.57 an hour. And so for those families, things were okay. And their total family income, when we added everything together, was about 166% of the poverty line, so pretty significantly above poverty for those families, but with a lot of variation. Only a quarter of them were over 200% of the poverty line, which is sometimes talked about as a real baseline for self-sufficiency. And 22% were still below poverty, even though they were off MFIP and still were working, which is significantly higher than the poverty rate for families generally. The other side sort of the equation, going back to the second lesson I talked about for the more challenged families, about 20% of the sample were still on MFIP and were not working. Virtually all these families are still poor, and they have a multitude of different problems. 32%